Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome, Catherine Haddad, to our podcast.
Thank you for having me on, Amelia. Yeah. I really look forward to talking to you today.
Yeah, we are very excited to have you as a guest. And you're also our first, like, real guest.
Oh, real guest? Okay, I'm your first. Did you have ghost guests before this?
No, only my little sister.
Okay.
She doesn't count.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're very excited to have you on. You also happens to be my boss.
Don't be nervous, Amelia. Don't be nervous.
No, I will be fine. And today we're going to be talking about your life.
Okay.
Also a little bit about your company.
Okay.
And we want to get to know you today.
That's nice.
Yeah. Okay. Catherine, can you tell me a little bit about yourself? Where did you grow up? And let's go.
Sure. I grew up in Michigan. My family lived in Michigan, and that's where I got my first exposure to horses. I did not grow up in a horsey family, as mm-hmm. is common in the United States. We don't have the huge cultural background of horsemanship in the United States. And I got my first pony when I was 6 years old. Mm-hmm. My family knew nothing about horses. So we actually, my mother took me to a Shetland pony farm where a farmer had let stallions run loose with mares and they were just randomly reproducing. And he picked out a 3 or 4 year old Shetland pony that was completely unbroken and said to my mother, "This one will be perfect for your daughter."
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was just running in the field with 400 other Shetland ponies. And he literally picked this small Shetland pony up in his arms. He was a big man. And he put it in the back of our station wagon. You would call it a combi back in the day. It was a station wagon. And maybe you remember it from American movies where you've got this big wide station wagon with the wood panels on the side. It was one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the pony home in the station wagon. And because we didn't have a barn, a stable, or a fence, it lived in our garage for 3 weeks until the neighbor could actually build a little stable for it and put a fence up, and then it could have its own place to live.
Yeah, what a start of the career.
Yes, it was fascinating.
Yeah. So that's your first pony?
That was my first pony, and I got to break it in with a halter and a lead rope, bareback, because we didn't have any equipment or tack or anything mm-hmm. like that. And my father liked to tell people that I got bucked off for 100 days in a row. He marked it off on the calendar until the pony finally stopped bucking me off. And that's how I learned to ride.
That's amazing. So you don't have any horsey people in your family?
None. I then got involved with a local group called a 4-H group, mm-hmm. which is kind of an agriculturally based horsemanship group. And I learned a little bit of riding through them, and that was my first exposure to instruction and teaching and learning how to ride.
Okay, so you have been very focused on horses since you were a small child.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah. Throughout my whole life, I competed in these 4-H classes at local fairs, and I did Western riding and what we called English riding, and I learned to drive horses in harness. It was very rounded education, but it was, I hate to say it, mostly self-taught.
Yeah.
And although I did have instruction from a few people early in life. And it wasn't until I went to the university that I started getting a formal education in riding from a local dressage instructor.
Okay.
So I was already 19, 20 years old when dressage came into my life because I had an interest in eventing. So I wanted to learn the dressage first.
So that's how it started, yeah.
That's how it started.
Very interesting.
Yes.
So when did you know that, like, this is what I want to do and work with and pursue the
Pretty soon, because I had a connection to horses from the very beginning. They understood me. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I understood them, but I had a real companionship feeling from the horses that were in my life. I learned a lot from them. I loved being with them, with the dogs and the horses that we had on our farm. That was really how I liked to spend my day. And by the time I went to university, I started learning the three sports of dressage, cross-country jumping, and jumping.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with the dressage part, but really what pushed me into dressage as a career was I found a woman who wanted me to buy and train a horse for her, and what she bought was a dressage horse.
Oh.
It was a Dutch horse. It couldn't jump to save its life. It probably couldn't have jumped out of a corral to save its life. So I had to train it in dressage, and that's how I ended up choosing that pathway.
Yeah.
And then I traveled. I went to the British Horse Society to get my instructor's license.
Yeah.
And from the British Horse Society, I did some traveling really around the world. And it seemed like, even though I had a different career plan at the university, I was studying pre-law, we say in English. I really wanted to be a lawyer or work for one of the intelligence agencies from the United States. So I was interested in either serving my country or becoming a lawyer. Meanwhile, I traveled, and in every single country I visited, I found a horse to ride, and my best friends were in the horse industry.
Yeah.
And I will say, one day I was sitting on a train between England and Scotland, and I was sitting there feeling that sort of rhythmical, you know, we weren't sitting on steam engine trains or whatever. What did they used to be called? The ones where they went chugga chugga chug. Those were coal-fired trains or whatever. But when you sit on a train, there's a certain rhythm to it on the rails. And I remember sitting there imagining the leather in the palm of my hand, and in that moment thinking about some of the riding that I had done and understanding a certain type of half halt.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking to myself at the time I would love to have a career in teaching and training horses.
Yeah.
And there were a couple other really big moments that led me toward what I wanted
really
to do.
That's really cool, yeah. Because what did, like, I don't know if your parents maybe had a plan for you, like, oh, you're gonna, aren't your dad a doctor?
My father was a doctor and a surgeon. And just about everybody in a Lebanese family, in what we call the Lebanese diaspora, and that means people who come from Lebanon and they live abroad, just about everybody in that diaspora is either a doctor, a lawyer, or an accountant, or involved in banking. Banking is also big. So my father really wanted me to be a lawyer, and I had that in my mind that that's what I would do.
Yeah.
And I got through my initial university education, but then I was traveling again, because travel was always a big influence in my life.
Yeah.
And I had an epiphany. Do you know what an epiphany in English is? A like a turning point in your mind. It's a discovery of knowledge in your mind, or what you think is knowledge. And I had been traveling in Inner Mongolia.
Oh.
And I didn't speak the language, any of the languages that were spoken there. I didn't speak Mongolian. I didn't speak Chinese. So I was really struggling to communicate with people.
Yeah.
But I could ride all their horses.
Wow.
Yes. And totally by accident, I showed up one day at a jumping field. I was in this city called, at the time it was called Hohhot in Inner Mongolia, and it was industrialized. It was a steel producing city. The smog was horrendous. You could not breathe in this city. So I grabbed a bicycle from this tiny little ruins of a hotel we were staying at, and I biked out of the city and totally by accident came across a jumping field, a sand jumping arena.
Oh, wow.
with Mongolian guys on these horses that looked like Arabians. They, mm-hmm. they were obviously descendants of the Barb horse because they all had dish faces. And these guys were doing stadium jumping in breeches and boots in the middle of freaking Inner Mongolia. It was a bizarre moment. And I sort of dropped my bicycle and I propped my elbows up on the fence and was clearly really interested in what they were doing. And I stood out because I was at least 30 centimeters taller than any of these people who were riding horses. And I was a woman and I was wearing what we call a tank top. So my shoulders showed and I had on cargo pants and tennis shoes. I did not look like a rider. But these guys came cantering over and this guy stopped and this actually happened. He was on a little black stallion and he started talking to me in Mongolian. I think it was Mongolian. I did not understand a word and I didn't understand anything and I didn't know how to communicate with him, but I kind of I bent my knees and I leaned over. This actually happened. And I made it look like I was riding like a jockey on a thoroughbred or something. And he jumped off his horse and handed me the reins.
Oh my God.
This actually happened. So I climbed the fence.
Yeah.
And then I got on his horse from the ground. It was a tiny horse, so that was no big deal. But I was in tennis shoes and cargo pants. And I turned the horse around and I put my right leg back and picked up the left canter lead, cantered around in a couple circles. I jumped an X, then I turned it into a line and I went over a vertical to an oxer. And then I turned to the right and put my left leg back and it did a flying change. And I cantered back to the guy and I did another flying change. And then I sat down and it stopped and I got off and I handed him the reins.
Yeah.
And in that moment, I had this epiphany. I understood that had I fallen off and broken my leg, I would not be able to say, take me to the hospital.
Yeah.
I couldn't ask for water. I couldn't ask directions. But I could get on a horse 6,000 miles from home and ask it in exactly the same way to go to canter and then and it would pick up the correct lead and do a flying lead change, point it toward a fence and count strides between the fences and it would do exactly the same as it did at home. And that is the moment where I understood that we do not train horses. They train us.
Yeah.
It became clear to me that the only way the language could be the same literally around the world was if the horses were training us how to communicate with them.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I thought to myself in that moment, you have a lot to teach human beings about communicating with and training horses.
Yeah.
Because you understand this differently than any of the instructors who I learned from. And that's when I decided to become an instructor and a trainer.
That's very cool. What an interesting story.
Yeah, it was a great story. It was a great story.
But I know you had lived a lot of years in Germany.
Yes.
How come you moved to Germany?
Well, I think I moved there in 1996, end of 1996, something like that.
So how old were you then?
29, because I promised myself that I was going to spend my 30th birthday somewhere where I was getting a better education. And I had come back to America after that Mongolian trip and after getting my certificate with the British Horse Society.
Yeah.
And I'd set up my own little training business. But I was, you know, I was training small riders at Michigan State University in collegiate sport. I didn't know a lot. I'd always been a good teacher because I was good with language and I was good with communicating with people. But I wanted to be one of the top riders in the world. And I knew that was not going to happen if I stayed in Michigan. So I had switched to training with a German man who was extremely talented. His name was Bodo Hangen. And after many discussions with him, he said to me, look, if you really want to compete with the best, you have to go to Germany and learn from the best. And it was through this man, his name was Bodo Hangen, that I made my connection to Siegfried Peilicke and eventually Willy Schulteis. And Willy Schulteis had been the trainer of Bodo Hangen. So I had already idolized him because my trainer, Bodo Hangen, was a hell of a rider. He was one of the most artistic, beautiful human beings on a horse. The connection that he made from his seat to his hand was flawless.
Yeah.
And I wanted to understand how to create that, not just in myself, but in every horse and every rider that came into my program. So I wanted to go train with Willy Schulteis.
Yeah.
And at the time that I wanted to train with Schulteis, he was not taking any more students. He was 70 at that time, 70 or 71. and I couldn't go directly to him. So I packed up everything and I went to Germany to train with his neighbor, who was Siegfried Peilicke. Mm-hmm. And that's how I made my way to Germany. I took two horses with me.
Yeah.
I sold everything I owned, which was not much. I think I had $3,000 in the bank, which even in that time was not much.
Yeah.
I had a handful of credit cards that I could take cash advances and borrow money on. And I took these two horses and a bicycle, because I couldn't own a car, with me to Warendorf, Germany.
Uh-huh.
Showed up there not speaking any German, other than what I had learned on television. We had this show called Hogan's Heroes, and you would hear things like Jawohl, Achtung, Herr Kommandant. That was all the German that I had.
Yeah.
And I showed up in Warendorf and ready to train, super eager.
Wow, that's very brave.
Yeah, I was scared to death, if I'm completely honest. In the first couple days that I was there, I thought about turning around and coming home because I thought more people would speak English. But in Warendorf at the time, people were very stubborn about speaking German. They weren't really that open to foreigners. And I'm talking, not talking people in the horse industry, more people at the bakeries and the grocery stores, you know, things that you needed to survive, get food and that kind of thing. But I made friends quickly enough within Peilicke's training business, and they all spoke English. And he was the neighbor of Willy Schulteis, and Schulteis was like a magnet for me. I was determined to train with that man.
Yeah.
And do you want to hear the story of how I met Willy?
Yeah.
Okay, so I happened to go to a little Kirmes fair. They called it Kirmes in German. It's a little local fair.
Oh, okay.
And elbowed up to the bar was this stout little guy with bowed legs and a big belly. And Peilicke went up to talk to him. And I was there with Peilicke, so I just went up to the bar with him. And we talked to this old man for a few minutes. And when we walked away, Peilicke said, "You know who that was?" And I said, "No, who was that?" He said, "That was Willy Schulteis." And I was like, "Oh, ah." So the next day, or maybe it was a week later, Peilicke went off to teach a clinic somewhere, and because he was gone, there was no one there to teach me. So I literally jumped the fence between Peilicke's home and Schulteis's phone. I climbed over it, not with a horse, okay?
Yeah.
I climbed over and jumped it myself, and I landed in Willy Schulteis's rose garden, which if I knew today, if I had known then what I know today, I never would have done it. But I landed in his rose garden, and I strolled through the rose garden into the stable, and I asked the bereiter, "Wo ist Willy?" It was the only German that I had.
Yeah.
And he took one look at me, and he said in English, "Mr. Schulteis is in the house." And I said, "Oh, okay." So I can't I think I waited. Schulteis came out maybe an hour later, and he wanted to know who I was. He was quite abrupt about it, very German. "Who are you?" And I said, "Oh, I'm Catherine Haddad. You met me at the Kirmes last weekend with Peilicke." "Oh, you're training with Peilicke. What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I wanted to ask you if I could come watch the training one day."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Will you come alone?" Now he'd switched to English. And I said, "Yes." And the next day I showed up at 8 o'clock in the morning. It was freezing cold. And he said good morning to me and indicated I could sit next to him. And I sat down next to him. And he didn't say a word to me for almost 2 hours. I didn't say a word to him. I just watched.
Yeah.
And then he looked at me and he had very broken English, but he said, "What do you think of the training?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Mr. Schulteis, this is the training that I know from Bodo Hangen. This is like an old shoe that you put your foot in and it fits and it feels comfortable. I like this training."
Mm.
And he said, "Do you want to train here?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I don't have room." And I said, "Oh, okay." And then we talked a little while about Bodo because he knew Bodo well. Bodo, who was my trainer, had been my trainer in Michigan. And we had a couple conversations about Bodo and how he died and how I then came to Germany to get an education, and about one of the horses that I was riding, because one of the horses I was riding at the time was closely related to a horse that Bodo had ridden with Schulteis.
Oh.
Same bloodline.
Yeah.
They were both black, both beautiful. And then I left.
Yeah.
And the next day, because I was young and courageous and didn't have any manners whatsoever.
A little crazy, yeah.
I was a little crazy.
Jumping the fences.
Yes, I rode my horse on the way. We were training the DOKR at the time, which was the German Olympic Committee. That's where Siegfried Peilicke trained his students. And I had trained with Peilicke that day, and I was riding back from there. And I thought, oh, why turn into Peilicke's driveway? I'll just ride my mare onto Schultheis's property. And that's what I did. I came riding up, and he was using the tractor to groom the manure pile.
Yeah.
And he looked at me, and he was really abrupt again. He said, what are you doing? Why are you riding on my property? And I said, innocent American, I wave and go, oh, hi, Mr. Schultheis. We talked yesterday.
Yeah.
This is the mayor I was telling you about. And he said, he was very grunty and gruff. He said, go in the hall. I want to see you ride it. And I said, oh no, I just rode her. He said, no, go in the hall. So I went in the hall into the riding arena. And he said, now trot and sit the trot. So I did. I sat the trot around the outside of the arena. And he said, stop, wait here. So I waited, took about 10 minutes. And he brought a rider with him and a young horse with a saddle on it. And he said, you ride this one. And then he told his rider, who I think his name was Bard at the time, he said, you get on Catherine's horse and ride it.
Yeah.
So his rider got on my horse and rode it beautifully.
Yeah.
I mean, it really changed the whole outline, the whole look of the horse. The connection became fantastic. All things I had been struggling with.
Yeah.
And I got on this young horse, and he took my stirrups away, and he said, sit the trot. I didn't know it at the time. It was a four-year-old trickaner, okay? Had I known what I know now, I might not have done this, but I took my stirrups off. I'm riding round and round in trot, and every time I pass Mr. Schultheis, he says to me, more forward, put your hands forward, more forward. And this goes on for about 10 minutes, and the only other thing he says to me is, put your toes down. And I put my heels down further because I thought his English was wrong. And he yelled at me, this is the way he corrected people. And he said, put your toes down. So I let my toes drop and I went more and more forward. And when we finally stopped, I was sweating. The four-year-old wasn't. My mare looked like $1 million.
Yeah.
And he asked me again, do you want to train here? And I said, yes, I do.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, come tomorrow at 2:00 and we'll talk.
Oh.
And then he gave me my horse back, and I went off. And the next day I came at 2:00, and he opened the door in his bathrobe. He'd been sleeping at 2:00 in the afternoon. And he said, I kicked two horses out. I sent them home. You bring yours tomorrow. And I said, okay.
Wow.
And I also understood in that moment that I would be showing Mr. Schultheis a lot of respect because I wouldn't want to get kicked out.
Yeah.
And that I would keep my mouth shut and I would work hard and I would listen to every word he said and absorb everything that I could. And like most German trainers, he was not very vocal. He didn't really tell you a lot except to do certain things. And you had, if you were going to learn, you had to steal with your eyes and learn with your eyes. And that's what I did at the time at Schultheis. But in those short years that I had with him, I learned really an entire system of how to... I was fortunate enough that I had a pretty good seat when I went there. He taught me how to use my seat and how to use my seat to train horses from the beginning level through the Grand Prix.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it happen over 2 years on many different horses. I had great experiences while I was there.
Yeah.
He actually got back on and started riding while I was there. He hadn't ridden in 2 or 3 years. And he started riding on my horse.
Wow.
And I watched him, I literally watched that man who was a master put the entire Grand Prix on my 8-year-old mare. She might have been 9 at the time. I can't remember if she was 8 or 9.
Yeah.
In the last 6 weeks of his life, I saw him take my horse from what I would call today a 4th or advanced M level to Grand Prix in 6 weeks. It was amazing to watch.
Yeah.
It was the most incredible learning curve I have ever ridden. Anywhere or any time in my life.
That sounds amazing.
It was amazing.
Amazing how a little bit of stubborn little...
Courage.
Yeah.
Ignorant courage can land you in the right place at the right time. I was born under a lucky star to have that happen in my life.
It's very impressive and such a funny story.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a lot of funny stories from my time at Schultheis. And then after he died... I actually tried to switch immediately to Rudolf Zeilinger because Zeilinger was a protege of Schulteis, and I was so enamored with this training system that I wanted to stay in it. But Rudy wouldn't take me as a student at the time because my horses weren't good enough. I went back to Zeilinger 5 or 6 years, no, maybe 7 years later. Mm-hmm. I ran my own training and teaching business in Germany during that time. And then I went back to Zeilinger when I had better horses. And that's when I really started training toward international competition. Did my first Grand Prix on Maximus, mm-hmm. and eventually went to World Cup with Maximus.
Super cool. But I want to talk a little bit about your system, like mm-hmm. how you ride the horses, how you train us, mm-hmm. your riders. And yes. can you talk a little bit about that?
I sure can. My system is based very much in what Willy Schulteis taught me. And it wasn't just through Schulteis, but Bodo Hangen had been a protege of his and Rudolf Zeilinger. So I learned from those three men really principally, and later augmented my training with some really cool, interesting horsemen who were very talented at what they did, like Morton Thompson, who is a fabulous in-hand person, and who also, Morton also really influenced my thinking about how I addressed my horses and, mm-hmm. and communicated with them. So my system is based on those early learnings from the Schulteis system, which was about the first 20 years of my life, and then some help from Morton Thompson, and later I trained more with Johan Hinnemann, who also changed my thinking a little bit. But I very much am a seat person. Yeah. I believe that the riders who come into my stable not only have to learn to sit in the saddle that I ride in, because it's a very simple, basic model, they have to begin to understand the motion of the horse's back, how to influence the motion of the horse's back with their seat, so that eventually most of the communication that is done is from the seat to the hand contact. Mm-hmm. The bridle is not there to stop the horse. It's not there to turn the horse. It's not there to correct the horse. It simply sets a limit or a boundary for the frame. And the rider's seat bones communicate from the hind leg all the way through the arm and hand to the bit, how the horse should develop its posture within the frame, and how the horse should move its legs within the posture that you set for it.
Yeah.
So that's a very simple system. It takes a while to learn, I think, because of its simplicity. Simplicity doesn't mean that it's easy. It means that it's simple, and that within the simple principles of teaching the horse the seat-to-hand contact, the connection from the hind legs all the way through to the bit, you will also gymnasticize the horse. The more power you can train into a horse, the more athletic and elastic it becomes in its body.
Yeah.
And that when these things are all combined together, and as Mr. Schulteis used to say, as soon as you can stop, turn left, turn right, and go whenever you want to, you can train the whole Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Those four things. You have mm-hmm. to be able to stop, you have to be able to go, you have to be able to turn right and left.
Yeah.
And if you can combine, use a combination of any one of those things at any time, you can create a Grand Prix horse. So my system of riding is get the riders young, teach them how to sit, don't tell them very much, just teach them how to sit, and then really, as you watch their seat and their understanding of their seat develop, teach them more and more about how to train each individual horse that they're riding within the system and the rules of the system. Don't pull, don't kick, don't whip. Now, come on, there are times, obviously, when you have to encourage a horse more. There might be a time when you have to turn with one rein, or, you know, obviously the number one rule is don't get hurt. So if the horse is going to be bombastic underneath mm-hmm. you, you have to do something to control it. But it's really a lot about refining communication. And going back to our original conversation about what happened in Mongolia, I am trying to teach my riders to listen to their horses.
Yeah.
Because if you get it wrong, the horse isn't going to do it right.
No.
And until you communicate it in a very simple way that the horse can understand what it is you're asking for, you're probably not going to get the response that you want. So if you're really listening and you're really thinking about what you're doing, your horse will tell you when you have made it clear to him mm-hmm. what you want. And then it's very, very important, that pat on the neck, that moment where you give the positive reward to the horse. Everybody thinks that's something that encourages horses. I think that's the moment where the horse goes, yeah, you got it. Where the horse goes, oh, thank God she finally understood it. She touched my neck. She said, good boy. She finally understood it.
Yeah.
So that's it's an affirming moment for both the horse and the rider. And I've found throughout my career that if a horse takes two or three steps that I really like, and I quote unquote reward the horse in that moment, they give the feedback to me that they'll repeat those three or four steps again straight away because they love it.
Yeah.
They know that you've connected in, that you've communicated A, B, or C.
Yeah.
They've understood it. You've affirmed that they've understood it. They've affirmed that you've understood it, and you guys can repeat it.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't. And that's the other thing I've learned rather late in life as a trainer. When you get those two or three steps that you really like, pat them on the neck and walk.
Yeah.
Because that horse will remember it.
Yeah.
And the next time you ask in exactly the same way, with exactly the same preparation, they will do it again.
Yeah.
But if you keep repeating and repeating and repeating until the horse fails, probably because they get tired and their body can't do it anymore, that's detraining.
Yeah.
That's de-escalating the training. And you're not really creating a horse who wants to work with you. So it's far better to reward early and come back again and try tomorrow than it is to just keep going until everybody's exhausted and you both fail at what you're trying to do.
Yeah, very good.
Are you happy that you're here, Amelia, to learn this from me?
Yes, I'm very happy.
Okay, that's a good answer.
Yeah. No, because when I came here 2 years ago to do my internship, mm-hmm. I didn't know that much mm-hmm. about you, mm-hmm. but I was directly very inspired about from your riding, and also when I got to ride for you a mm-hmm. few times, mm-hmm. but especially last year when I was here and we advanced it a little.
Yes.
I learned a lot.
Because I think the first year that you were here, you observed me training Hazel, a horse named Hazel.
Yeah.
And you got to observe a lot of that training.
Yeah.
And that horse changed a lot in those few months you were with us.
It did.
And then you came back, maybe it was probably
a year later. Yeah.
And you saw how much the horse had changed in that time, and then I let you ride her,
mm-hmm.
and she taught you what I had affirmed with her.
She
taught you what she taught me.
Yeah.
And I was able to explain it to you so that you could understand it as well. And that horse was born a teacher.
Yeah.
She's
amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful teaching ability and a very good communicator, very clear communicator.
Yeah.
So when I finally got how she wanted to be ridden and I could tell you how to do it, it was just like, boom, learning moment.
Yeah.
That was nice.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was really fun. So I'm very glad I got to come back and yes. work for you.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy to be training with you almost every day.
Good.
And to see you ride.
Good.
It's very fun.
Good.
And you do have some Swedish connections.
I sure do.
Yeah.
So I've been working recently with Tina Wilhelmsson,
mm-hmm.
Sylvan. I always forget. Sorry, Yanni. I forget to put the name in there. Yes, I really enjoy working with Tina. And every now and then, Bo Jenne comes along to do some training in hand. We also have a new person we're working with in hand who I'm learning a lot from and really enjoying. But the Swedish connection is wonderful.
Yeah.
I've always had a very strong Swedish connection because those 20 years that I lived in Germany, I actually lived in Fechte, Germany, which is a nice stopover point for the entire Swedish team when they came down to do competitions in Germany or any other part of Europe. So Tina used to stop by, Louise Nathorst used to stop by, Per Sandgaard used to stop by, and they would use my stable as an overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd make pancakes and tell stories to each other and have a funny night. And then they would move on to a horse show that hopefully I was competing at also. So I had some really good Swedish friends growing up in Germany, if you will. I was also very close to Patrick Kittel at the time. And so naturally, when I got back to the United States, I kept those connections. And it's really fun for me now to get feedback from Tina because she's such a top competitor herself, and she's always been one of the riders that I stole from with my eyes.
Yeah.
I love her seat to hand connection, and everything that she says to me makes total sense.
Yeah, it's really nice. And mm-hmm. what do you think about Swedes in general? Do you like to have them in your stable?
I love Swedish people.
Yeah.
So the last, oh, I don't know, 8 or 9 years that I lived in Germany, I had a young Swedish man working for me. He uh-huh. ended up marrying my assistant trainer. His name is Christopher Nilsson. Big shout out to you, Christopher. I hope you're listening. one of my favorite people in the whole world. He, as a young man, believed he was Superman, and later in life had some challenges happen in his life where he needed his Superman powers, and he overcame those challenges.
Yeah.
If you look into that, you'll understand he had a real health issue not too long ago, and being the Superman that he is, he overcame it through sheer willpower and determination. Yeah. And he's always had a great sense of humor. And Christopher and I traveled for years together on the top international circuit with my Danish horse, Maximus. And we did all the top competitions, and also with Cadillac, who was a Danish horse. So the Scandinavian influence is in there. I was good friends with Jan Brink. I showed at Falsterbo, at Flinge. I never say that right.
Flinge.
And Gothenburg. I showed in Stockholm. I mean, I had some wonder. I have wonderful memories from competing in Sweden.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's really nice. Yeah. We have some good shows.
Yes, you do. It turns out I did my DNA not too long ago, and I'm also 3% Swedish, just so you know. That's like a bragging point.
We're almost like related.
We're almost related. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That's funny. Yeah. And now you have some Swedish people in your team.
Yes, of course I have you. Yeah. That's my number one Swedish person. And we're constantly getting interns in from your school in northern Sweden, which I understand is how many hours north of Stockholm?
4 hours.
4 hours north of Stockholm. I can't even imagine being 4 hours north of Stockholm. That's practically the North Pole.
Yeah.
But the school at, and I'm going to say it wrong, Naturara.
It's fine. Yeah.
That's how what I say.
Yeah.
Sends me fantastic interns. I mean, I'm getting girls and boys out of the school who are so well trained in the handling and grooming of horses that they come for 8 weeks to do an internship as an educational thing. And when they leave, I'm thinking of stealing their passports.
Yeah.
They're so good in my stable, and I love having them there. They have fantastic work ethic. They come in with a great sense of humor. They put their heads down. They work. They know how to move in a stable. They know how to be with the horses. They're like sponges. They love to learn anything I can teach them. And it's a fantastic relationship.
That's amazing to hear. Yeah. You're very happy to send them there, because that's how it started for me.
Yes.
Coming to you.
Yes.
So it's very fun to keep going on that wheel.
Yes. Yeah. And now that I've formed this new business, Norcordia, Norcordia is always looking for interns, for grooms, for young riders that we can support, for people who are going to help us in our business. And we look at your school as a true source of good, of people steeped in good horsemanship, which is what our company is all about, good horsemanship.
I want to hear a little bit about your, you know, most memorable horses, like your heart horses.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you said horses, because I have had the incredible luck in my life to have more than one.
Yeah.
And I would say that my first really influential horse in my life was Maximus JSS, and I could almost cry talking about him. He was...
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A very special horse in my life. Christopher Nilsson and I called him the captain because he was just in charge of everything, or the general, and we called him the general. It was at the time that that film came out, The Gladiator. And I named Maximus after the figure, Russell Crowe's figure in The Gladiator, because he was such a strong character. And he was easy to train, or he had an easy job in training me because I really wanted to learn. And boy, he was quick to train me. If I did something wrong on that horse, he let me know instantly. It was like, boom, you're done, wench. You will do it this way. So he was my first international Grand Prix horse, and I traveled the World Cup circuit with him and was really determined. My first year in international competition, he took me to the reserve spot on the U.S. team in 2006 for the World Equestrian Games at Aachen. And out of that, we qualified for World Cup, which was in Las Vegas that year. That had special meaning for me because I had never competed internationally in dressage in the United States. I left as a punk kid from Michigan, and I returned a top international competitor at World Cup. We placed seventh, so we were in top. We were top 10 in our first World Cup. And it was the first time my family saw me ride in dressage, so that was kind of cool. They started at the high end. And then I returned to Germany with him, and I was training a couple other horses. I had always purchased my horses around the age of six because I thought at six you could really see in a horse if it had international potential and if it was going to learn everything. I was bringing a horse up by the name of Winyamarl, and also another horse by the name of Cadillac. Winyamarl was a Hanoverian, and Cadillac was a Danish horse. And I have to say, Cadillac was my biggest challenge mentally. He was a very difficult horse to train. He was a Solos Carex. So he kind of, I think he came out of his mother piaffing. He did that by nature. But to get the horse to go through the short side of the arena without shying at something was very difficult. And that hits on a lot of things. I was also studying Buddhist philosophy at the time, thank God, which is an odd thing to say if you're a Buddhist. But I was studying Buddhist philosophy, and it really helped me breathe and tolerate the personality of Cadillac, because he was a very special individual. A lot of top riders had tried him before I had, and a lot of them with more knowledge than me, and they didn't buy the horse. He was irregular in the passage. He had his tail to one side. His tongue would come out. And, you know, he had this Solos Carex blood that, that caused these distractions. He he was visually often distracted. And I was able to fix all things, except you can never really truly change the character of a horse. And until the day he died, and he died rather tragically, until the day he died, he was a shyer and would always be a shyer. And I could only show him an international competition if I took a deep breath and told myself, don't respond to it, don't react to it, ride him as if he's never shied in his life, and if he takes a step to the left, you just turn him to the right. And we had done a lot of, this is a horse who'd thrown extra pirouettes into every test from M level to Grand Prix on the way up. And I did a, Morton Thompson, praise the Lord, came into my life at that time. And Morton had trained Solos Carex as a young horse, so he understood this shying thing. And Morton really helped me understand the nature of the horse and do a lot of what you would today call natural horsemanship training to, it not only trained the horse to trust me more, it trained me to trust the horse more. So we really became a pair. And I could, in the end, almost ride that horse through fire. Didn't mean he wouldn't shy while going through it, but I could ride him through fire. And he ended up doing a fantastic freestyle, which I think you saw on YouTube.
Yeah, I saw it the other day with Robin.
At that was at the Olympia, the stadium at Olympia in London, which was a very tight stadium. The crowd is sitting almost on top of the dressage arena. There's 5,000 people there. It's very loud. It's very noisy. And this horse did a beautiful freestyle. You might have seen the one time he stepped sideways in it. But, you know, it was a freestyle, so we could add the sideways step. And he could handle applause. You know, at the end of this beautiful freestyle I did with him, 5,000 people were almost, they weren't on their feet because it was a dressage crowd in England, but they were really applauding us.
Yeah.
And he took the applause absolutely no problem. That was fine with him.
Like, yeah.
What you couldn't do is ride him, like I had a corgi dog at the time who was black on top and white on the bottom. And every day in training at home, every single day in training at home, he shied at the damn dog sitting in the arena. I mean, every time I passed, there was this big discussion about he couldn't make it past the corgi. And after 20 minutes, he'd be fine and we could finally start training. And then the corgi would roll over and all of a sudden the white belly was showing. And then it was another 20 minutes. So it was a really difficult horse, but I learned so much from him and I loved him. And he was one of my very best horses in my career. And it was a very, very sad moment for me when he passed.
Yeah. It's a beautiful story, but it's very sad.
Ended sadly.
Yeah.
And then Winnie Morrow, who's still alive, by the way, and retired in a herd of jumping horses up in northern New York on the Madden estate or the Madden farm. He's retired with all of their old show jumpers. Winnie was a fabulous horse. He was a cheeky little thing, and he loved being in a horse show. He loved it when people were looking at him. He loved being photographed. He loved being a rock star. Mm-hmm. And he was fabulous in the freestyle and ended up being my second horse that I took to the World Cup final.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he was really cool.
And there's a lot of, I've seen a few videos on YouTube. So if anyone is interested in watching,
You just look up Winnie Morrow Haddad on YouTube.
And Cadillac, of course.
And Cadillac is on there. The one horse that was really influential in my career that there isn't a lot of video on is Semper Fidelis. Mm-hmm. I rode her for a sponsor in, I think, 2017. Yeah, 2017. That's probably the best horse I ever had the pleasure of connecting with in my life. That is a horse that I still ride in my dreams.
Yeah.
And I mean that literally. Yeah. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, I have been riding her.
Oh my God.
Yeah, we had a really strong heart connection and everything that I knew from all of my other horses, I could use in the training of that mare. And I think I was her person. I was her person who got her to understand what her job was. And I really showed her the reward she could get from doing a good job. And she loved it. When we were together and we showed together, she loved being in that partnership with me. And I loved being in that partnership with her. It was really one of the strongest, most positive things that ever happened in my riding career.
Yeah, that's amazing. I don't think I've seen a video of her.
No, there aren't very many out there. I only competed her a few times.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, fabulous horse.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
Okay, but now, how many years did you live in Germany?
Amelia, I lived in Germany so long, I don't even have a sense of humor anymore. That's what I tell people, but it's not true, as you know. I used to joke about that a lot. In fact, there was a very funny moment in Stockholm at Globen. I was competing Maximus in a World Cup qualifier.
Mm-hmm.
And this reporter and the television crew came down to that basement, that tiny little postage stamp of a basement where you had to warm up for Globen. It was a really small warm up. And I had been warned by my Swedish friends, if you bring a horse to Globen, bring one that pee-offs because it's the only warm up you can do. You have to pee off to warm up and then you can go in the arena. And they came down to interview all of the riders individually. And I didn't really understand when they were interviewing me, you know, how they were going to use it. And what they wanted was a 1 or 2 minute clip they could use so that when you entered the Globen Arena and you were going around the outside,
it's on the big screen.
It would be on the big screen. I didn't know this, you know, ignorant American. So they asked me, you know, how long have you been training in Germany?
Yeah.
And I said, I've been training in Germany so long, I don't even have a sense of humor anymore. And they put this on the Jumbotron above the arena as I was cantering around the outside getting ready to enter my freestyle test. Yeah. And then this comes up on the big screen, and of course the entire Swedish audience laughs.
Yeah.
They find it really funny. But as I ride by Herr Rixinger, the German judge, he puts his finger in the air and shakes it at me. I laugh. He smiles. I mean, what can you do at this point? You have to, you know. You know,
and did he like your freestyle?
He did. Okay, and I scored very well at that particular World Cup qualifier. In fact, I think it cinched my nomination to World Cup that year.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Good thing he had a sense of humor.
Yes, humor wins friends. And he had to have a sense of humor because the entire stadium was laughing in that moment. And I'm sure if anybody listening to this podcast, there will be some people who remember that moment. It was it was memorable.
It's very funny.
Yeah.
So then you moved back to America?
Yes, I met my husband in 2010. Mm-hmm. I had decided to bring Winyamaro back to the United States to try out for the World Equestrian Games that was being held at Kentucky that year. And our qualifier, our selections, were in the United States at Gladstone, which is in New Jersey. That was our team headquarters at the time. And my husband was a veterinarian there on the panel, judging, you know, which horses were sound in the jog, and he was also available for treating horses if they needed it. My horse was the only one not getting treated during that competition, I wish to remind everyone. So I was I really wanted to meet my husband, so I I was just trying to find ways to meet him, you know? And I did eventually meet him during this competition, and I think I can quite honestly say the two of us fell head over heels in love.
Oh.
We had so much in common.
Yeah.
It was almost weird how much we had in common. We had grown up, he'd grown up in California, I had grown up in Michigan. We both had a strong Middle Eastern influence in the way we'd grown up. He'd lived in Iran for 4 years with his family. My family is Lebanese, so my husband and I love the same foods, we love the same cultures. We had the same favorite tea, the same favorite wine, the same favorite ice cream. We grew up with the same family values and the same work values. He was also self-employed. He had his own veterinary business. I was self-employed as a trainer. We both loved horses. We both grew up riding. We're both lovers of dogs. So
very compatible. Yeah,
like, you know, it was almost like we grew up together. And we spent, you know, during that 6-week training period leading up to the World Equestrian Games, we spent every evening together, talking late into the night. We dated, and it was very clear by the time the WEG had finished that we were probably going to be seeing a lot more of each other. And it wasn't long after that, it was a few months after that, that he proposed to me, and I said yes. Although I said yes, he mumbled something. I didn't really understand him at the time, and I said yes, and then he said, "Oh, you'll marry me?" And
you're
Well, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. So we actually ran off and eloped and got married.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then you stayed in America.
Yeah. Actually, not right away.
Oh.
Because I was running a training business in Europe, and I was pushing toward the Beijing Olympics with a couple of horses. And we both, he was horseman enough to understand that to disrupt my training routine was probably not a good idea 2 years before the Olympics. Plus, I owned 28 horses at the time.
Oh my God.
I was breeding. I was a very successful breeder in Germany. And I actually was a successful breeder before I was a successful Grand Prix rider. So I had a lot of horses that I actually owned. And there was no way to sort of like sell 28 horses and move to the United States. And I also couldn't move to the United States with 28 horses. So we agreed that I would stay in Germany for 2 years until the Beijing Olympics had passed, or at least my attempt to make the team had passed, and that I would move back to the States the end of 2012. And that's what transpired. I did not make the team that year, but I sold a lot of horses and ended up coming back to the States with, I think there were 9 on the plane and 2 dogs and a couple cats and some staff. And it was quite the big, big move from Germany to back to the United States. And I flew straight to Florida, which my husband's never quite forgiven me for because our home is really in New Jersey.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was October 31st. It was Halloween. And the Florida season was about to start. Yeah. So why would I fly to New Jersey? That made no sense. Flew the horses into Florida and set up a base here.
Yeah.
And the first 5 or 6 months that I had returned to the United States, I operated out of Florida.
Okay. And then Wellington was like up and running?
Oh yeah, Wellington, you know, Wellington has been the number one spot in the United States to pursue dressage sport in the dressage industry in the United States. It all circles around Wellington.
Okay, yeah.
So, and it's been that way for 30 years.
So, like, what do you feel is the difference between America and Europe?
Well, if I may be blunt, no one's ever accused me of being discreet. What in Europe, the industry is centered around the professional. It's a very professional industry. And everything that turns within the horse industry turns because of professionals. So there are systems in place that train professionals to become top riders and top trainers. There are internships and apprenticeships that you can have. The horse shows are set up that the professionals can take not one, but two or three or four horses and afford to take those horses to the show. There's prize money that at least refunds your expenses. Mm-hmm. When you get into the bigger shows, you can actually make some money going to the shows. Any of the teaching and training that you do is geared toward sales of horses, so you can support your professional career. The amateurs in the sport really center most of their riding around private stables that they built for themselves or in riding clubs. And there are certain instructors who will cater only to the teaching local people how to ride. But most of the professionals in Germany at the time or in some other parts of Europe, they were really pushing toward competition because that's what you did if you were a professional.
Yeah.
In this country, the sport is much more amateur-centered. So most of the money in the sport is not in the hands of the professionals. It's in the hands of the amateurs, which when you first hear, you think, oh, well, that's not that big of a deal. But it is. It's a huge deal because it means that most people who are spending money on horses are amateurs. And professionals have to teach amateurs in order to make enough money to pursue the sport.
Yeah.
Because they can't sustain themselves with prize money. So that changes the whole dynamic of the sport. I think it's very difficult in the United States to get to the top of this sport without a sponsor who supports you.
Yeah.
And the price of doing business in the United States is 6 to 7 times higher than it is in Europe.
Yeah.
So yes, you can charge more for training here, you can charge more for lessons here, but if you want to own your own horses in the United States, you are probably going to go broke. So you need someone who is able to sustain the suspenses, yeah. The expenses on a top horse.
Yeah. And riding wise, like how people train here and mm-hmm. what do you think? Like, is it any difference training?
Of course. And I mean, we have some really talented riders in the United States, many of whom have been educated in Europe, including myself.
Yeah.
I actually think training around the world has changed.
Yeah.
Not that it's any different in the United States. What's changed in the last 20 years is 20 years ago, if you really wanted to learn the sport from A to Z, meaning you wanted to be trained within the sport, understand the sport, understand how to train a horse from the beginning to the end, you had to travel to the master to do it, like you have done, Amelia. And the people who are still serious about the sport, that's what they're doing. They are immersing themselves in a day-to-day training program where they're riding a certain number of horses and being educated by a professional who has a system. What's changed is a lot of the talented riders in the world now don't go through that kind of training. They learn to train from what they see on Clip My Horse and YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
So they see the ideal. They see Isabel Vert go down the center line at World Cup. They see Lottie Fry, you know, doing the world championships. They see Catherine Dufour riding a top horse in a freestyle, and they take that image and they learn to train from it, which is not a bad thing. Even I use those videos to tune myself up. If I'm on my way to a horse show or if I'm having a problem with a horse, I look to see some of the best videos on YouTube and on Clip My Horse to help myself retrain my eye. But what it does is you don't get to see the problems solved.
Yeah.
So if you're learning to train horses, there's a lot of problems that come up. Even on a great horse that learns quickly, there's a lot of backtracking. You, as a trainer, you go, shoot, I've gone too far in pushing this horse to do this too early. Or that horse is showing, you know, at 7, he's doing a fabulous 7-year-old test, but I see him in training at home and I see that his downward transition from the trot to the walk is really screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that if I'm going to train him to pee off this year and pee off well, that transition has to be corrected. You don't get that on YouTube.
No.
You don't get that on clip my horse.
You only see the finished result. You have to.
You only see the finish.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of people are able to reproduce what they see visually from the best riders in the world, but they're only reproducing it for a few moments, and then they don't know what to do when a problem arises.
Yeah.
And quite often they're reproducing that moment too early, too soon, before they've put in the fundamentals and the foundations and the building block on the horse that you need to avoid, number one, injury, but number two, stress-related problems and problems that arise if the horse is asked too much too soon. So I'm a firm believer in building blocks. Like, I want to see horses doing certain things, certain fundamentals, before I will challenge them to do a higher movement or a movement that is beyond that horse and rider combination that I see in front of me. Do I challenge combinations? Absolutely. But I challenge them, and my eye is there assessing and analyzing what the result is. And then I can either say, you know what, back up, we have to do this. Or I can say, press on, he's ready, get in there, let's mm-hmm. do it. And that fails if you're not in a system of riding and training.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I think Tina Wilhelmsen would agree with me on this. She's been in a system her whole life. She still trains with Louise Nathorst. And she uses Louise as her eyes. And they've always had a wonderful training partnership.
Yeah.
So people who have grown up in a training partnership, they have longevity. They have the ability to address problems in horse and rider pairs throughout their career and correct things. And there are also people who have some real credibility and legitimacy in the business because, you know, if you go to them and you're like, look, this horse has this problem, am I ever going to be able to solve it? They can come up with a way for you to do it, or they can say, wrong horse. Wrong time in your career to have a horse like this.
Mm-hmm.
Move on to a different one. Or this horse isn't going to be happy doing what you're asking it to do.
Yeah.
Which is, for me, a very big factor in training horses. I want them happy in their job.
Yeah.
So if it's not the right horse for the right time or the right moment, or it's not the right horse to be pushed in that moment, I'm going to let you know that.
Yeah. That's good.
I think you can see this in your own daily training right now in my business,
yeah.
Amelia. You have a couple. You have a beautiful bay mare and you have a beautiful black mare to train.
Yeah.
And I can kind of equate those two horses. They're both talented. They both have enough gait to do our sport. They're the same size. They're relatively close in age. They're definitely close in the level of their training. But in those two horses, you see one horse that you know you can advance quickly.
Yeah.
And the other horse is going to take a whole lot of time.
Yeah.
And I can tell you right now that the black horse will far exceed in sport what the brown horse or the bay horse is going to do.
Yeah.
So, but I can also guide you so that your training of those two horses keeps each individual horse happy and makes each horse successful in the place in the sport, in the highest level of sport that it can achieve.
Yeah.
And not push beyond that, because then we end up with something that's not what we want.
Yeah. It's very good, and I think I'm very happy to be working with so many different horses because mm-hmm. I get taught so much mm-hmm. from each mm-hmm. other horse, and also to have your eye on me every day. It's very good.
And I'm happy to have you riding for me,
yeah.
So it's a good combination.
It is. But now I want to talk a little bit about Norcordia.
Okay.
Your company, which I also work for.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah.
You are actually employed by Norcordia, not by me.
Exactly.
Because I am my company.
Yeah.
And my company was founded in 2021 with a total of four co-founders. I'm mm-hmm. one of four co-founders. My partner in the jumping sector is Ulrik Clemensen, who is based in Denmark. And we pulled in two guys from the business sector, one guy from data, who is Frank Eskard Fjord. And one guy from basically from business and franchising, and that's Brian Hedlund Nielsen. They're all three Danish guys. And at some point, I'm gonna actually teach a podcast on doing business with three European men. Okay,
yeah.
But I laugh about that. They're great partners. I love working with these guys. I have learned so much from the three of them, and I think they've learned a few things from me too. And I think we're an incredibly strong team in building this startup business called Norcordia APS, which is founded in Denmark. And I am the CEO of the US division, which is Norcordia USA. We are a global organization And we are buying and selling horses, but our number one, the first piece in our chain of DNA, if you will, is horsemanship. We want to treat our horses so well that finding them a home is easy because we understand the horses inside and out. We understand what makes them tick. We understand where we're going to and who we're going to find their best partnership in. And then we try to arrange it for the horse. We help that horse choose his best partner.
Yeah.
And in doing this, we hope that we will be educating people like yourself, a lot of young people in the world who will come through our system, learning good horsemanship from us, learning to ethically source horses, meaning when you go out to buy a horse from a breeder or a trainer or an owner, you make sure that they're getting their just value for the horse. Obviously, we're not giving our money away. We're trying to get the best price we can on a horse. But what we're not doing is partnering with people at the moment and saying, oh, you know, you're going to pay all these expenses and we'll let you know what you get when the horse is sold. We're very transparent.
Yeah.
We make really fair partnerships with people. We know what it costs to train a horse in Europe. We know what it costs to train a horse in the USA. We're transparent about it. If somebody wants to partner with us on a horse, we let them know what to expect. Mostly we buy our horses outright and then we move our horses to a location either in Europe or the United States at the moment where we know that horse can achieve its best training level, and its best value and be partnered with the right horse and or the right rider in the right market. So, you know, if we buy, let's say, a 10-year-old pre-St. George horse in Europe, that has leveled out at 66, 67%, and no one's training it to the Grand Prix, but it's a really kind, beautiful horse that is super easy to ride. We know that if we vet that horse thoroughly, which we do, it has to pass two x-ray exams, not one, but two x-ray exams. It has to pass a clinical exam. It has to pass a riding test because we test its character and its personality. We know if we move that horse from Europe to the United States, there are a lot more people in the United States who would be willing to pay more money for that horse than there would be in Europe. Mm-hmm. So we've put the horse in a market where he can best find his best partner, and we make a profit by doing that.
Yeah.
Whereas if we have a 4 or 5-year-old horse that looks like an international prospect, we know that it's cheaper to train that horse in Europe, and we have several partner locations in Europe, including some very top riders in Europe, that we can put the horse with to further its education, get it some show experience, won't cost us as much money to train it there, and probably the number of people looking for a 4 or 5-year-old horse that's super talented are going to be, though there's a larger number of them in Europe than there are in the USA.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how we maximize our selling potential in each horse, if you will. And then we've taken this concept of maximizing the location and the geographical location and the training of each horse. And we've taken our whole group of horses and placed them into what we call sport horse investment portfolios.
Yeah.
And our portfolios are made up 80% of dressage horses and 20% of jumping horses. And in each portfolio, the seven to eight horses that are in each portfolio can be located at any one of our global trainers. They might be in Denmark, they might be in the United States. We try to actually diversify the geographical placement of the portfolio so that we have in each portfolio horses with a bunch of different trainers. We do not invest in infrastructure. We're not buying stables and putting loads of money into stables because that just makes us raise the price of our horses. We're getting ethically sourced horses. We're putting them with the right trainers in the right place. We're allowing private investors to invest in each of the collections or portfolios of horses, which gives us more capital to expand the business. And we are returning creating quite an interesting ROI, which is return on investment for our investors.
Yeah.
So I can just give you one figure that I think is impressive. We started with a capital between the four of us of 240,000 euro. We each put in 60,000 euro. That's the capital we started with in 2021. And we now, through purchase, training, sales, and growth, now have assets within the company of over 5 million euro in horses.
Oh, wow.
And that's 3 years later.
Yeah.
So we are very careful in how we expand, very careful in how we generate profit, very careful in the people we hire into the business. So welcome, Amelia.
Thank you.
We find you to be a real asset to us. And we're very careful. We're very conservative, sometimes to the point where I just get impatient because I've been a horseman for so long. It's hard for me to pass up on a deal if it doesn't fit in financially or something like this. But my partners are really good half-halts for me. And we're careful in how we invest our money, and we're really doing right by our investors at this point in time. And I think Norcordia is going to be a very strong company going forward.
That's very exciting.
It is super exciting.
And I feel like it's only been 3 years.
Yes.
So basically the year I came here, and it's been moving up very fast.
Yes, we are really, we're doing very well. And I actually give a big nod to our chairman here, Brian Hedelund Nielsen, because Brian has... he's taught me so much about business, and and also to Frank, because Frank is our accountant, and Frank is always stopping me on the numbers. He's like, no, Catherine, we can't buy 3 horses this month. We can only buy 2. And they've been really great at half-halting me and making sure that the horses we invest in are horses we know we can turn over, and turn over in the estimated amount of time that we think it takes to sell them. And they've been great at directing this business to a point where we are really, we're in a phase where we think we can grow and expand and do it safely and do it to benefit the main business as well as our investors.
Yeah.
And that benefits everybody because, you know, there are people out there who will tell you, oh, horses should not be used in commerce. They shouldn't be investment tools. Let me tell you, that's what makes the life of the horse better.
Mm-hmm.
If you can buy a horse, put it in the right place, train it ethically, make it happy, sell it for a profit, that profit goes toward educating people like yourself to do it again. It goes toward taking care of that horse, paying vet bills, paying the best farriers in the world, providing them with cooling systems for their legs, providing them with a safe stable to live in, getting them safely to horse shows, and, you know, it...
you're thinking of the whole full circle.
The whole full circle. Creating ethical profit in the horse industry is good for horses.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Yeah. Very cool. Mm. It's going to be exciting to see how the company develops throughout the years.
Yes. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And now, we've been talking for a while, but I want to ask you a little bit about, we've had a few, like dressage has been a big topic lately, like in the news, like everywhere, like it's been some scandals and stuff like that. Where do you think the future of our sport is going, and how would you like to see it turn out in the next few years?
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Years.
Well, this is a poignant question at this time, of course. I think dressage has all, in the time when I lived in Germany, dressage was scandalous then too. Mm-hmm. There are always people from the outside looking in who snap a picture in a moment. You can snap a picture of a rider at any point in time, even in the best ride in the world, where you don't like the position of the horse's head and neck, or the horse opens his mouth a little bit. Remember, a horse produces foam in its mouth because it chews. It chews on the bit. Even if you're riding without a bit, it will still chew. And chewing is a response of the activation of the hind legs. Horses loosen their jaws when you get their hind legs moving. So even if you're riding in a hackamore, some horses will still foam at the mouth. The point being, if a horse is going to chew, he's going to open his mouth sometimes. And sometimes someone will photograph that moment and then say that the horse is being abused because his mouth is open. And these are people who don't understand our sport. For me, the future of the sport lies in education and teaching people who don't understand about horses that horses are actually part of a communication network that man, that humans have with animals, yeah. Meaning dogs, dolphins, horses, anything that you can train or bring into your life in a beneficial way. Man has had a beneficial relationship with the horse since ancient times, yeah. Since the first time a horse came off the grasslands in Asia and got curious about what a guy was doing and decided that he was going to hang out with this guy because this guy could feed him hay or any kind of grain. You know, horses have agreed to be beneficial partners with humans. They benefit from it, and we benefit from our partnership with them. So where do I think the sport is going? I think the sport is going more toward the people who are involved in it, not being so egocentric and looking within, but instead look without and say, hey, how can I educate people about the benefits of being with a horse? Mm-hmm. And there are huge benefits. Horses teach us so much about ourselves. Whether we are working in a para riding program, para is not a good word to use here because I'm not talking about para sport, but handicapped riding programs and or therapy riding programs where people are physically challenged, but they are empowered by sitting on the back of a horse.
Yeah.
Do you know why that happens? The actual motion of sitting on a horse's back as a horse moves, like in the walk rhythm, that motion triggers the human brain, the cerebellum, which is the learning and language part of the brain, to function at a higher neuroactivity.
Wow.
So the actual motion or the physical act of sitting on a horse's back and walking on a horse triggers your brain to function differently and increases your learning power.
Yeah.
So yes, horses are beneficial for man. And what dressage does at the highest level is it melds two minds. The horse, by the way, has a comparatively speaking to other animals, has a much better ability to engage its cerebellum or to learn and communicate than, say, it has a higher ability to do that than a dog, and it has something very close to a chimpanzee or a dolphin, which are getting close to the human ability to use the cerebellum in the brain. And probably I'll be corrected on my terms at some point because I tend to skim over these scientific things and I go, oh, look, the horse is rated at 76% and the dog at 72. That means I'm more capable of teaching my horse to do things than I am my dog, which in real life is true too because I cannot train dogs. But horses are eminently trainable. They understand human emotion. They read human emotion. They read human body language very well. And in training the dressage horse, this is why we train in the saddle that we do.
Yeah.
Because you can communicate through it so easily. A horse senses your heartbeat when you're sitting on it. This has been scientifically proven. A horse, think about it. In our saddle, if you look to the left, all of our horses turn left because they feel the 15 pounds of your head turn left. They know you're looking over there. And you somehow communicate to them without even turning your hands. But they feel you look at a letter and they go in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that that's what you want to do. So horses communicate with humans. Humans communicate with horses. And the state and the art of dressage is a beautiful, beautiful thing. Where does the future of the sport lie? In teaching people that we are trying to achieve and then show in a public forum how beautifully, well, and elegantly we can communicate with our horses. And when you see top people at the top level of sport, like Lottie Frye, Catherine Dufour, Charlotte Dujardin, Isabel Vert, some of these people in their greatest tests and their greatest performances that they do publicly, you can, their communication, their circle of communication with the horse is palpable. You can see it. Mm-hmm. You can feel it. And you can train other people to see and do it. Yeah. Isn't that, in fact, what we do with judges? Many of the dressage judges that travel the world to judge our sport have never ridden as well as Catherine Dufour, but they can see and feel it, the level of communication that's required for her to get her horses to the place in the test that she does. The same with Lottie Fry. And when they see and feel that level of communication and that circle of communication, they come with the 9. Sometimes they come with the 10. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to find a way to communicate to the public at large how important it is for man to continue to communicate with animals, because it's all part of a bigger circle of life.
Yeah. Beautiful way to put it. You're very good at describing.
This is, this is what I believe.
Yeah.
I have always believed this my entire life, and it's been my mission since I started teaching people, is to teach them how to communicate with horses. For instance, one of your interns, Elise Peter, who was here not too long ago, she's 17, wonderful young woman to work with, really a sponge, wanted to learn so badly. She had a horse in the stable that was hard to manage. She, for some reason, he was always doing circles around her, and you know, she'd try to lead him somewhere, and he was leading, and he was knocking her to the side, and she'd put him in the cross ties, and he'd be pawing and impatient. And she said to me one day, "I don't know what to do. I don't know how to handle him." And I said, "You know what? Let's do a training module on that." And we took him out, and I showed the girls simply how to back that horse up really quietly, make eye contact with him, give him a hand signal, and tell him, "Stay in your space." And it, actually, he doesn't know what the words "stay in your space" mean, but he knew what the eye contact and my hand motion was. And he would try to get in my space again, and I'd back him up, and I'd say, "Stay in your space." And as soon as he accepted to stay 3 or 4 feet from me on a loose line, while I made eye contact with him and just relax and not move, and I rewarded him for it, he would become quiet. And then I taught him that as I walked away, he would follow me, not get ahead of me. If he tried to get ahead of me, I'd stop, I'd back him up, and I taught him to follow me. And I taught Elise to do the same thing. And lo and behold, within 24 hours, the horse was standing quietly in the cross ties, perfectly self-confident with himself. She could lead him all around the farm. She could tack him up. She could make him ready for me. And there was no loss of communication. They were both comfortable with each other. But she had to learn his language. And he had to learn where his boundaries were. And then it was all good. Simple.
Very good,
But good.
Yeah, Catherine, I have a lot of other questions for you, but I feel like we're going to have to do another episode one time.
Sure.
And but it's been very, very inspirational and awesome to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you. And thank you for asking me all of these questions after 11 o'clock in the morning, because you know my rule, no questions before 11 a.m. Because I need my focus and my concentration to ride my horses at home. So this is exciting that we did this. After the 11 o'clock rule.
Very good. It's been so fun, and I think this is going to be very appreciated. And I really love to hear your opinion of things.
Well, you're welcome. And thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.